Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for asking. I'm so excited to talk about the book and talk about E.T. and to show the book, just because I feel like it's very under wraps. It's been very kind of top secret. So I have it in my hand. Well, I have it on my desk, but now it's in my hand. So so it's here. Yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Just one little note, if you don't mind, I think Samaya may have asked you just to do the audio on the phone, just in case of the backup.
That's right. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
No problem. All right. Hold on one second. I never, for some reason, I never know where the...
Are you an iPhone?
The problem is that I have too many... apps. I have too many icons on my thing. I found it. Here you go.
Oh, okay, great.
All right. Perfect. It's going now. All right. So it's there. There's a backup. We should be good.
Great. So let's start with just a bit about yourself. Who are you? What's your background? And leading up to what led you to write this book?
Yes. So my name is Kasim Gaines. I am an author. I am a cultural historian and also just a lover of film, television, theater, just the arts in general. And so I've written several books on sort of these great moments in 1980s pop culture. I wrote a book on Pee-wee's Playhouse and A Christmas Story and Back to the Future and The Dark Crystal. And there was an opportunity to sort of throw my name in the hat or my hat in the ring for this great book that Inside Editions was publishing on E.T., the extraterrestrial, for the 40th anniversary. And I put my name in for it and I was hoping that I would get it. And then it seemed like it wasn't going to happen. And then it seemed like it might happen. And, ultimately, I was just so incredibly honored to be chosen, not just by Insight, but by the team at Amblin to write this because, you know, if you, number one, if you are my age, E.T. is just this amazing cinematic masterpiece that you can't do any better, I think, than E.T. And if you are someone who writes the kinds of books that I write, working on the full history of a film that is as important to just the world, truly the world, as E.T. is, it doesn't get any better. So I'm so happy to have my name on this and have my words in this, and I'm excited by it.
That's wonderful. And just so for people, including myself, is it the decision something that comes from the top, people at Amblin, or is it more so from the marketing, or how does it work? Are you aware of that?
I'm not fully aware, but my understanding of it, which may be a little bit inaccurate, is that, you know, like most major corporations like that, you know, I think Amblin has a division that works on their publishing side. So, you know, everything from, I know there's like a new little golden book that is coming out, that's an E.T. one. You know, there are all sorts of different publishing projects.
Merchandise
and things like that. So I think there's a team that works on that, but it's great because I think when everyone has an opportunity to see the ultimate visual history, you'll really appreciate how generous really everyone at Amblin was in terms of the photographs and the ephemera that are in this book. It's not just text. It's also, I'm trying to figure out what I can even tease here, but it's like, there are annotated copies of scripts. There are some, actual pages that are reproduced here of meetings of transcripts of meetings between Steven Spielberg, Kathleen Kennedy, and Melissa Matheson, the screenwriter. There are storyboards, but there are also some of the pictures in this book are actually from Steven Spielberg's personal Polaroid collection that he took on the set. And so it's you know, I think sometimes when there are things like this, especially for a film that is as well known as E.T., people sort of say, well, what new could be in the book? I've heard all of the stories, I've seen all of the pictures, but even myself, like, I have been blown away by what people have been able to find to put in something that is truly, I mean, and it's a thick book. It's a coffee table book, but just the size of it, I mean, it's a big book. So there's a lot in here, and I think people are truly going to be very pleasantly surprised.
That's incredible. And were you growing up, did you have like a Spielberg childhood, like, you know, watching not just the directed stuff, like, you know, Amblin produced like Back to the Future, obviously wrote a book about it. Mm-hmm. Just run that by me a little bit, just your background on that, if any.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was born in 1986. So I'm a child of the 80s, but in a lot of ways, a child of the 90s in a sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny because I didn't realize, I saw E.T. when I was very, very young. And I didn't realize that E.T., I sort of think of it as like a quintessential Spielberg film, but I didn't really know as a kid that Jaws and Close Encounter, like there were things that came before E.T. that were really kind of different. I mean, obviously, as I got older, you can see the similarities, but the sort of thematic connection style between certainly style and just, I think, what Spielberg is always trying to convey through his work, through such different stories. You know, it's family, it's, I think, they're all kind of coming of age stories, and it doesn't matter if they are children, you know, they don't have to be children. It's like these like stories of like self-discovery, I think is what I'm getting at.
Absolutely. And
that rings through in so many, you know, even something like Jaws, which doesn't seem like it's a self-discovery story, but it really is, mm-hmm. in the same sort of way. So, you know, I just grew up really with Spielberg films being a part of the palette of what I digested as a kid. And and I think certainly, definitely, Amblin as a filmmaking company, just having their tentacles in so many films that I loved as a kid, even really, really like small films. They seem to really do very well, especially in the 90s with a lot of like, you know, probably low to mid budget, you know, like family films that I just inhaled as a kid.
Right. No, that's fantastic. I think I shouldn't say my childhood, I'm the product of the late 70s. And I didn't know much about anything about E.T. until after Jurassic Park came out.
Okay.
So in 1993, I don't even know who Spielberg was. Right, I had seen Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark, but not knowingly who was behind it as a kid, like maybe when I was like, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, 9 years old. But I remember when Jurassic Park came out, and I'm getting to E.T. in a second, when Jurassic Park came out, I didn't get to go see the movie until it came on VHS 16 months later. Mm-hmm. And in that process, I came to learn, like, I knew that's what I want to do. I want to be a filmmaker, and that's what I'm doing, you know, with my career. In that process, I saw everything Spielberg and Amblin related.
Wow.
And I remember going to a VHS store, which is there was no Blockbuster at the time. It was called Rogers Store here in Canada. And I remember there was a kids section, and there was a VHS with a boy on a bike and, you know, with the moon in the background. And it just, I'm like, what is this? And it was for 99 cents. I still remember the rental. Wow. And I picked it up, and it had an amazing impact. And it's, you know, such a similar to Jurassic Park. They're very similar filmed in my view. They're very, very personal, mm-hmm. and about, you know, ordinary people in extraordinary situations. So E.T. is incredible. And I have something here. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
Oh yes. Oh my god.
That's the 20th anniversary edition. Actually, I've never opened it.
I've only seen it online. Wow, that's beautiful.
Film cell. And then it comes with a certificate. And then this book, which is a screenplay. You've probably seen this for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And then obviously there's soundtrack and then the film and the 20th. Have you seen the 20th anniversary version?
I have seen the 20th anniversary version. Yes, I have. And I actually got it on DVD. I mean, right when it came out. So yeah, I'm very, yeah. I didn't see it in theaters, but I did get it as soon as it came out on DVD for sure.
So did you probably remember the whole thing about the bathtub scene and the CGI and all that stuff. What did you think of that?
You know, to be honest with you, at the time in 2002, I don't think I
registered that
as much as I mind now, you know, and I think it was just sort of like, in my mind, I think, you know, the big thing that's sort of sticking out to me is like Spider-Man, you know, I feel like I was just so much more accepting of CGI that now makes me like wince a little bit. Like, I think, yeah, you know,
it's too much of it now, right?
Yeah, we've gotten so much better at, I think, identifying it. So I thought it was kind of an interesting project at the time to go back and just sort of give some digital Botox to E.T. But it's funny because even in the book, you know, I spoke with Mr. Spielberg about, and not just him, but I spoke with a lot of people about the 20th anniversary release. And it's interesting that I think they've all sort of come around to the sense that the 20th release isn't particularly worth watching, except perhaps maybe as like an academic exercise, you know. You know, and I think there's lots of good reason for that. You know, I am a firm believer that film should sort of exist in the time and space that it was created in. You know, yeah. I don't mind when they add scene, you know, like adding the bathtub scene to me wasn't so much a problem, but that actually was a scene that they, well, obviously it's a scene that they tried to do for the 82 exactly. film, and it just yeah. worked. The puppet didn't work. So as a result, I understood why that wasn't in the film, of course, the 82 film, but yeah, I don't know. I haven't gone back to rewatch the 2002 release.
Yeah, I even think if my memory serves me right, I believe Steven himself kind of later kind of felt that it's something that he shouldn't have touched. I'm not officially sure if that's accurate. I'll have to double check. But yeah, it I remember when I went to see it in theaters, it threw me off because the puppet is just so lively and so... what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's just so tangible. You can feel it even watching it, right? Like the eyes, the movement and everything. But when they had the CGI, it completely threw me off. But I'm actually wondering if the 40th anniversary edition that's coming into IMAX next month, I think August 12th, if they're going to have the 82 version or the 2002 version. Do you know? Mm-hmm.
The 2002 version will never be in theaters again. I will tell you, the Steven Spielberg was incredibly clear when we spoke that he sort of prefers to pretend that the 2002 version did not exist. And so
I'm glad.
Yeah, and it's funny because he said you have to remember also, and I can't remember if he said this to me in our phone calls or if this was something that I read, but I remember, or maybe even Kathleen Kennedy might have said this to me, but you know, this was the time where George Lucas was reopening the Star Wars, the original trilogy.
Yes.
And there was sort of a sense that audience, and they also did very big business, you know, those Star Wars films, the special editions of the original trilogy. And so there was sort of this thought that audiences would want to see, if they were going to go into the theaters and see a re-release, they would need something new. And, you know, obviously E.T. kind of got like the George Lucas treatment a little bit.
Yeah.
So that was, I don't know if that would have even happened if it weren't for those Star Wars releases.
Makes sense. I remember they had Jabba the Hutt digitally inserted in the film. I think it was a Return of Jedi or maybe Empire Strikes Back.
He was in,
but anyways, movie. Yeah. Go on.
I was going to say, he was inserted in the first one. Was it Return of the Jedi or was it A New Hope? I know that there's a scene that wasn't in the original film.
Oh yeah, it was New Hope. It was inside
New Hope, right?
Besides the Millennium Falcon, I think they just showed him sort of, you know, like a warm
crawl. Right. Han like steps on his tail or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Who did you interview for the book? I know you probably did it a lot, but just kind of some names and some experiences of learning about the film or the people involved. I know there's so much material on E.T. I'm not sure if you've seen E.T.'s Laserdisc documentary.
I did.
Yeah. There's just so much stuff. So what was the new stuff aside from what you mentioned and who you interviewed and what new information they gave you?
Oh, boy. So there was a lot of new information. And so just so you know, my sort of process, you know, I started, of course, with inhaling every documentary that I could find, and not just like the laser disc, but also on the 2002 re-release, there was a documentary as well that was different. There were a couple of really great television documentaries that had been out. I think some of the really good ones were from the UK, I think. pardon me. And I think I just started with reading everything that I could and watching everything that I could and using that as sort of to create an outline for myself. But then obviously I did do interviews. I spoke with Steven Spielberg. I spoke with Kathleen Kennedy. I spoke with Drew Barrymore. I spoke with Rob McNaughton. I spoke with, Carol
Henry Littleton.
One more time.
Henry Thomas.
I did not speak with Henry, and only because he was filming his show. The title is escaping me. It's on Netflix. I think The House on Haunting Hill, I think is the name of it. Yeah, sorry if I've had the wrong title there, but it's a very successful show. People will know that it's a show. sorry, Henry. But he was in between filming at the time. I did speak to Dee. pardon me. To Dee Wallace, Peter Coyote. Oh my gosh, I'm just trying to think. And then a lot of the special effects people, Dennis Muren, who led the special effects team, and a ton of special effects people. I don't want to try and name them all because I will forget people, but a lot of people. If I didn't mention Carol Littleton already,
yeah,
I spoke with her. And also, I do want to acknowledge that I spoke also with Mike Fenton, who was one of the casting directors, and he is the person who is reading with Henry in
the scene of the dog.
Yes. And it's great. And Mike, I spoke with him for my Back to the Future book as well. Really nice guy. And he's actually since passed away since we did the interview. And so it's really nice to have been able to speak with him about not just that amazing audition, but Mike really chose Henry, you know, or helped choose Henry. Mike helped curate a process that led to Steven choosing Henry, but he really played a very important role in the film. And so it was great. But then I also spoke with some people who, I spoke with the person who built E.T.'s eyes. I spoke
was it from the Medical Institute?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. I did.
I spoke with
Matt Demerit, who is one of the actors inside of one of the E.T. Body puppets. So yeah, I'm estimating probably around 50 people or so that I interviewed.
Wow.
And that's in addition to obviously pulling from things that had already been out there. And so, There's a lot. And I think what really fascinated me about the interviews was just sort of, it's one thing to know that E.T. was a film with a small budget and it ended up doing, you know, amazing business, of course. Yeah. But it's another thing altogether to sort of hear about how that small budget impacted them making the film. And it really led to a lot of really creative decisions because they just didn't have the money to do, you know, whatever they wanted. Yeah, so it's fascinating. And I think, yeah, it was kind of like really renegade filmmaking. This was a small film. This wasn't, you know, Close Encounters. This wasn't Jaws. This wasn't, you know, this was meant to be a small personal film. And they were all surprised. I can honestly say, I think in speaking with especially Stephen and Kathy, I think almost in a sense, they're almost still surprised that E.T. went on to do, you know, the business that it did, even after 40 years. I should probably also mention, I spoke with the person who made the Atari game as well. And there's some really great stuff in the book about the Atari.
Nice.
How that came to be.
That's pretty cool. I'm just gonna make some references about the movie that you were talking about. The Netflix is called The Haunting of Bly Manor, with Henry Thomas. And for those people who don't know what Laserdisc is, which probably a lot of people do who's watching this, is a big version of DVD, essentially a super high quality audio and video. But going back to the E.T.'s box office, I wonder. You know, sometimes this is not just in E.T.'s case. A lot of actors do this, directors, studios. When Spielberg had made Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which you probably know, he had E.T. at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And then Columbia came back and said, we're making this film called Starman. Mm-hmm. So you got to, you know, we'll give you the rights back and you can take it wherever you want. And he took it to Sid Sheinberg at Universal. And then the rest is history. You know, just it's interesting and fascinating how we all make decisions. And it's not a bad thing. It's just one of those things that changes the course of history. And you wonder if Columbia was doing it, would E.T. would have been that big? Would you have Henry Thomas in it? Would you have Drew Barrymore in it and all that stuff? So it's interesting how that works.
Yeah, and there was a very similar situation with Back to the Future as well. I mean, just in the same exact way that you're describing. And I think it's that was a little surprising to me in terms of, you know, obviously Steven had such incredible success, but there is no such thing as a sure thing. And I think what was interesting was E.T. was sort of considered to be a little bit too Disney, and in that being a pejorative sort of thing, because Disney at the time was not the Disney of today, where a lot of their films, you know, especially their animated films, connect with adults, and they're really, you know, films for all ages, not just children's films. But at the time, there was criticism that like E.T. sounded too much like a Bambi sort of film, and people just weren't as interested in that, especially from Steven, who hadn't really made films like that. It's funny because obviously when something works and it's a success, it seems like, well, how did everyone not know that it was going to be successful?
Exactly.
But if you look at where Steven was at that point in his sort of filmmaking career, E.T. was a great departure from the other projects that he had worked on. And yes, obviously there, you know, I like to call Close Encounters sort of like E.T.'s sort of people, like spiritual, like cousin or something like that. You know, they're not exactly siblings, but they're close, they're related. But those two films are light years apart, you know, if you can, you know, not grimace too much at the pun
there. Yeah. What was just a couple of things, if you can remember, when you were interviewing everybody, it doesn't have to be anyone in particular, anything that you learned that was like, wow, I did not know that. That was so fascinating. And that was so mind-boggling that that had occurred. Anything that comes to mind without, obviously, I know you can't give away too much, but whatever you can.
I think what really was mind-boggling was the process of casting the kids and particularly casting Elliot. It was a really interesting, and again, we've all seen that audition video of Henry, but even before that was taken, you know, that was the end of a really long process. There was, I'm trying to decide how much I want to say here, but there it was a really interesting, complicated process. And there was another actor who was almost chosen to play Elliot, and they just had a very creative interview process or audition process for that. And Henry definitely earned that part. And I think the film obviously, you know, rests on his shoulders in a lot of ways. But it's interesting to see that it almost wasn't him. And that was something that I didn't know the full extent of until I started talking to people.
Is this the story where the parents weren't too keen on it and there was a financial disagreement? I think Spielberg said that in one of his interviews, or is it a separate story?
I think that's a portion of it. I mean, that's a portion of it, but I think sure. there were other factors as well that led to it. Just the chemistry wasn't right as well. And I think how they sort of helped to determine that was really interesting. So there were a couple of factors. That was a part of it, though, for sure.
Sure. And how they determined to make that decision, is that in your book? Like that whole yes. story?
Yes, okay. The whole story's in there.
Wonderful. As a filmmaker, as a documentary filmmaker myself, I know the process of interviewing ample amount of people and then going back into editing room or, you know, in your case as well, can be daunting. You know, okay, how do you put all this together? Like, what's the arc? What's the story? Tell us about that. Like, how did you interview everybody that you needed to interview first and then went back in and started writing the story? Or was it, you know, at the same time, simultaneously, essentially?
Yeah, it's a great question. I probably, and to be honest with you, I don't know if I 100% even remember. I'm going to assume, just because this is the way I normally work, that I probably did about maybe 10 interviews before I started writing. And then I would write simultaneously while I was interviewing. And it's complicated because, as you probably would imagine, most of the people that I interviewed weren't sitting around waiting for, you know, me to knock on their door and say, would you like to talk? So, you know, everyone that I spoke to was very generous with their time. But it was a scheduling thing. You know, it was a little tricky. And some people, a lot of people actually were very active, or are very active in the film industry. And, you know, I remember when I spoke with Steven, he was literally on his way to come to New York to do, I think, some location scouting for West Side Story. Like, he was literally like, we were talking as he was like, you know, leaving to go to the airport in like an hour, like something sort of thing. So, I mean, you know, we sort of were working in a lot of time constraints in that regard. So, pardon me, I didn't have the ability to like get all the interviews done and then write the book. But it was interesting though, pulling it all together. And I think part of it also was when you speak to person A, sometimes they will say, oh, and you know, I was working on this with person B, and person B maybe wasn't on my list of people to speak to, but you realize that they're sort of important to the story. And then you interview person B, and then they'll, you know, so a lot of it was just sort of pulling at the thread and just seeing how much I could get done in the time that I had, because, you know, we wanted to get this out for the 40th. So it also was, you know, really being, you know, racing against the clock a little bit.
So it's essentially like a documentary. Like, you know, you hear someone say make a reference, and you're like, you know, try to wonder if this is something I should interview, and you do sometimes, and then by the end of the completion, that interview is gone in the garbage because it wasn't working.
Right.
So in the book, like when you were writing it, you know, you, like you said, you had a first draft done. And then was it also a process that you went back to the interviews, all of them or some of them, and then you pick something else and you're like, oh, this might go in there. Like, just run that process with us. Like, how many drafts was it that you had to do before it was like, I'm sure a lot, but just for the audience.
Oh boy, that's a question that triggers PTSD. How many drafts? Oh my gosh. I don't even know if I would want to admit to how many drafts. I'd never work again. I think there were a lot. We all wanted, definitely myself included, we all wanted this book to be as close to perfect as possible, because E.T. means so much to all of us, and it means so much to everyone who's seen it. And I think it also means so much to Steven. You know, this is the film that he still cites as his most personal film and one of the films that he's most proud of that he's made in his entire career. And so I was very happy to, you know, anytime there was a suggestion of something to change, or could we add more here? Can we find more information? Can you go back and re-interview someone and see if they have anything new to offer? Certainly, as you described, where I had transcripts of all of my interviews, and sometimes I had to go back and say, you know, maybe there's something else in here that I can pull. And then obviously, as you would probably imagine, and I know, you know, as a documentarian, this is true as well, sometimes two people that were in the same room have different memories of what happened in that room, you know? And so some of it was negotiating that, and, you know, who was the better storyteller for that particular story. And so taking all of that, it is daunting, but to me, it's very exciting, because I think what I'm able to do is I'm objective in terms of I wasn't there, and I have no real stake in it besides just trying to capture the best history. And so I guess by way of example, what I'm getting at here is when I wrote my Back to the Future book, I think probably the best compliment I've ever received, maybe on anything, was from Bob Gale, who was one of the creators of Back to the Future, producer, writer.
Yep.
And he said, you know, I'd been told that Back to the Future is a part of cinematic history, but I didn't fully appreciate it until I read the whole history in this book, and that the ability to not just know my story, but also while I was working on this, they were working on the DeLorean, they were working on that. Like, everything was sort of happening all at the same time, but I didn't have the ability to see that, even though he's a Back to the Future expert. You know, he say, you know, he was there, it's his baby. But there's always a part of the story that you don't know. And so to be able to sort of put all of those pieces together, I think is great. I'm hoping, my dream is that hopefully, you know, Mr. Spielberg will learn something about E.T. from the book as well. You know, and I think that would be exciting.
I'm sure it would. It's interesting, right? Like, when you are reliving your life through someone else's perspective after, mm-hmm. 40 years?
Right.
So I'm sure there would be something there that he probably didn't know about. You know, when you interview so many people forget stories. And even like when you have the 10th anniversary, 20th anniversary, or 30th anniversary, always new information comes out because people forget stories that they went through and experienced through. Mm-hmm. When you interviewed all the people, and what was it, over the phone or email or in person or...
They were mostly over the phone. I think a few of them were over Zoom. None of them were in person.
Hmm. Did you visit Amblin?
I did not. I'm in New York, and it's funny because a lot of the work on this was being done when we were COVID locked down, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, pardon me. So because of that, yeah, I was planning on going out to LA, and there was actually like really, you know, working on plane tickets and everything, and then everything just stopped. Everything just stopped. But it was great because then people had time, you know, people had time to sort of talk and that was nice. You know, a lot of the filmmakers were continuing to work. You know, I know when I spoke to Kathy, she had just gotten off the scoring stage for The Rise of Skywalker, I think. I mean, she had literally just, you know, she was actively working. I spoke with John Williams. How could I forget to say I spoke to John Williams?
I actually forgot too. I mean, that's such an integral part of it.
I spoke to John Williams. That was great. And I spoke to a lot of people. Now I'm just thinking about this. I'm like, yeah, I really did speak to a lot of people for this book. But yes, sorry. That's a real long answer to your question about how the reviews were conducted. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Did you listen to the score ever when you were writing or in a writer's block?
Did I? I certainly did. I listened to it on a almost nonstop loop. Yes, I did. And I don't really, I'm not big on listening to music when I write, but I do find that when I'm working on films that just have like amazing score. The E.T. score is just amazingly beautiful. And I listened to that on an almost constant loop when I was writing.
Because it literally takes you into that world, like you feel that you're actually there, right? And your favorite part in the book, without revealing, I don't know how you're going to tell me this without revealing it. Anything that stands out for you in the book that you could talk about at a personal level, like something that, okay, let me rephrase that. When you were writing it, there was something, or when you were interviewing people, was there something that gave you goosebumps?
What an interesting way of putting that question. There were moments. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, obviously, is speaking to Steven Spielberg, you know, and interviewing him about E.T. Not just speaking to him, but also about E.T. And he was just the most generous and forthcoming person, you know. And I say this to say, you know, it's your fear, or my fear as a writer, and I'm sure it's similar as a documentarian, is you don't want for someone to sort of slip into the same story that they've told, you know, to everyone, and you've heard the story over and over again, and you can recount it almost word for word. You know, you want them to say something new. And I thought that a lot of what he offered was information that even in all of the interviews that I had read, there was still new information that he was able to give, and new perspective. And I thought that was really amazing. And actually, I was partially stalling because I was trying to think what gave me goosebumps, but I know what gave me goosebumps the most. It was the answer to this question. So I'll tell you the question, but I won't.
That's fine.
So I asked a number of people along the way, but particularly Steven's answer to, if E.T. were released today, do you think it would be the same sort of global phenomenon that it was in 1982? And his answer not only sort of surprised me, but also was so beautifully articulated and really, really, really did give me goosebumps. And I knew as soon as he gave me that answer that that was the ending of the book. I hadn't gotten there yet. I didn't know exactly what the journey was going to be, but his answer was such a great ending that I knew that that was going to be it. And it is the ending of the book.
That's exciting. What do you think? Do you think it's going to have a similar impact that it did on a personal?
It's hard because I'm colored now by so many people's answers, but I think I feel like I can't give an objective answer at this point, but I think that it was interesting to hear people's answers along the way. And I think that what would have been my answer and what I anticipated people's answers to be doesn't always align or didn't align always with what people said. I think people feel like there was something very magical about that period of time that made E.T. such a phenomenon, and that the part of the reason why it has been so hard to replicate that success is because there was just a unique, it was a unique moment, you know, where Stephen was in his career, Melissa Matheson, Kathy Kennedy, Frank Marshall, John Williams, like everyone was just at a certain moment in their lives where they were sort of really primed to tell this story about family and about growth and about, they were sort of in a nostalgic, reflective sort of mood while also really trying to put their finger on the pulse of kids in the 80s, and really, not having it be something like The Fabelmans, which is, Steven's new project that's coming out, but something that was really of the moment while also, spiritually, I guess, being of the 50s and 60s. I don't know if any of that's making sense, but.
No, it does. It does. And I feel Back to the Future, E.T., Gremlins, like a lot of those films that came out in the 80s. Yes, there was that element of novelty, like, special effects, puppets, science fiction, time machine. But if you really focus on all those films, especially Back to the Future and E.T., it was just about people.
Right.
Right? I mean, Back to the Future just had a time machine. Other than that, what was there? Like, there was nothing sci-fi about it.
Right.
It was just like a story of a family. And now with the success of Stranger Things, I do feel, personally for me, I think E.T. would do reasonably well from a box office standpoint, if you really want to talk about that, because I think people are at that stage. A lot of people have been reintroduced to E.T. because of Stranger Things. I don't know if you have seen Stranger Things at all.
Oh, have I?
Okay, yes. Good. Yeah. I remember the first season, that I don't know if it was the last episode, the whole E.T. reference where the van flips.
And yeah. Like,
yay!
Yes. Big Stranger Things fan, for sure.
What did you think of the latest season?
I loved it. I thought the latest season of Stranger Things was so, so well done. I love even like the staggered release of it. I loved the runtime of the episodes. I thought it was, they're like, that's gold. I mean, Stranger Things is just absolute gold to me. I think it's so great.
I gotta watch this season again, because this season didn't do it for me as much as the first three did. Maybe I missed
really
something. A lot of people tell me it's great, and I was, maybe for me it was more about, it was just way too many effects than the characters, but maybe I missed something. I mean, I'll have to look
at it. It's so funny that you say that, because I felt like the opposite. I really felt like it was so focused on the characters.
Maybe
that's so funny, and I that's really interesting. And I felt the way that you're describing about the third season a little bit, and I've heard people say, I have a couple of friends that rewatched it in anticipation of the fourth season, and I was like, I don't know if I felt as strongly about the third season. And they're like, no, you have to go back and rewatch it. It's really good. And I was like, I will. I guess I will. But the fourth season definitely pulled me right back in. I was really excited by it.
Maybe I'll watch it just before the fifth season comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm going to do the whole thing too, because the fifth and final.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit. I mean, I might come back to E.T. again. I'm just kind of going all over the place. I didn't honestly know that you wrote a book about Back to the Future, which is really cool. It's funny because literally last night, Friday night, we sent an email to Bob Gale about a request for an interview for our podcast as well. Do you know Stephen Clark?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that book. For people, when did it come out? What transpired? That was it through Amblin as well, and publishers same route, and who did you speak to?
Sure. So that book came out in 2015, and it was called, or it is called, We Don't Need Roads: The Making of the Back to the Future Trilogy. Yes. And you know, for me, I was actually kind of surprised, because there was an official book that came out in, I want to say, 1990 or 1991, that was a very thin book. And I was just sort of amazed that there was no big sort of comprehensive, you know, book on the making of Back to the Future. And so this was something that I started to pursue in 2013, and I reached out. Funny that you mentioned Stephen, because Stephen Clark was one of the first people that I reached out to.
I've known him for a good 25 years.
Oh my God, have you? Oh, isn't he the nicest guy? Like, sincerely, he's such a great guy.
He's such a cool guy, yeah.
And he knows everything. I mean, and if he doesn't know, he knows how to get you to someone who does know. You know, he's a really, really great guy. So Stephen helped put me in contact with Bob Gale, and it was really kind of funny because Bob was so generous with his time, and I mean, I don't know, I owe him like a steak dinner or something. I really owe so much of the book to him, because I swear there wasn't a question that I couldn't have asked him. He answered everything. He gave me amazingly comprehensive answers. We both agreed really early on that anything that I was asking him that was like formally for the book, that we were going to do via email, because he wanted to be able to really give detailed answers. And then even when the book was done, he offered to like fact check it for me and just make sure that everything was right. So like, let me tell you something. This is a memory that I will never forget. It was right around Christmas. I was driving to Orlando from Northern New Jersey. So that's a drive.
Yeah.
I was with my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, and our two dogs, and Bob had the book for a couple of weeks, and I knew that he was going to be giving me his feedback sometime within that period of time, but I didn't know exactly when. So it happened to be, as I was driving down, I got a notification on my phone that Bob had read the first chapter. He did it in chapters. I just want you to picture this. So I'm driving down and I see like chapter one notes, and I'm like, oh my God, I want to know, even though I'm driving now. And so my wife
is
reading. No. So my wife is reading all the, you know, page three, you know, here's my feedback, here's my thoughts of the whole thing. And she's just reading, and I'm, and I'm just digesting. And then like, whoop, chapter two comes in. And so I got all of Bob's notes as I was driving from New York to Orlando. And it was just so funny, because the whole ride down, I was just like, he likes the book. I can't believe it. I'm so glad he likes it. And, you know, it was just a very interesting way to digest that. But I spoke with.
That sounds like a making of a book.
It was right, isn't it? It's like a
you should write a book. You can actually make an episode of a TV show about
right. I have a friend who also writes a lot of pop culture books, and we always joke that, you know, we have to collaborate on like the making of the book, you know, because they're always so interesting. But I spoke with both Bobs, Bob Zemeckis, Bob Gale. I spoke with Leah. I spoke with Chris Lloyd. I did not speak with Michael because Michael was filming his TV show at the time. And I spoke with that. I did a ton of interviews for that too. I spoke with a lot of the effects people. I spoke with, and then like Claudia Wells, Harry Waters. It might be easier to do a list of people I didn't speak to, and people that I tried to get that I couldn't get were probably not surprising. Crispin, I did not speak with. And my holy grail person that I wanted to speak to was, of course, Eric Stoltz.
Yes.
But I did not speak to Eric. But some of the stories about Eric were amazing. In fact, a piece of the book is actually excerpted in, Vulture ran an excerpt of the book, and it's a piece about Eric Stoltz. It's only a small portion of the Eric Stoltz story that's in the book, but it's a cool little excerpt. So if you want a little taste of the book, you can seek that out and read that either for free or for their, you know, 99 cents or whatever they're, you know, if they make you pay for it.
Yeah, no, it's something that comes up in all. There's a documentary series on Netflix. I forget what it's called, but they've done a documentary episode.
Movies That Made Us?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in the Back to the Future episode of the Movies That Made Us.
I got to watch it again.
I'm there.
I'm there. I saw it a year ago, whenever it came out. I'm going to watch it again. Yeah, I apologize. I missed it.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Everybody talks about Eric Stoltz, right? And you wonder kind of what we were talking about, if E.T. would come out now, would it be the same? And it's sometimes you wonder, nothing disrespectful to Eric, I mean, he's a fabulous actor, but you wonder if the film maybe would have been a lot more impactful or less impactful or maybe the same. Sometimes you wonder about those things, how life kind of takes you through a journey. And, you know, when you're living in that moment, especially as Bob Zemeckis and Gale, you're probably thinking, that said, we're done. Like, what the hell are we going to do? How are we going to... Because I think they shot, 30% of the film with him. Something like that. Did. Yeah, they shot
a lot, yeah.
And the similar thing happened on Aliens, too. I don't know if you... I saw that on the Movies That Made Us Aliens episode. They had an actor where they shot most of the stuff with, and he got fired or he quit or something happened. But what was the... What was different? What was something that you learned from the Back to the Future book that you decide at a personal level, you're like, okay, I'm not going to do that when I did that, or I'm going to do that when I did, you know, the previous book.
Sure. So I think, sorry, I have a little sip of water. One second.
No worries.
So I think Back to the Future for me was like a gargantuan book, and it, I think what I learned is how important it is to, if you have to tell a story that people know, you have to find a new and interesting way to tell it, which is sort of like an obvious thing. But Back to the Future posed some interesting challenges for me, particularly because when you pick up the book and you start reading it, it actually starts while they're already filming with Eric. And I think the first page of the book is when Zemeckis starts to get an inkling that it isn't working with Eric. And then obviously I go back and sort of fill in, how did Eric get cast? How did this film get made? You know, but obviously everyone who's picking up that book knows when they start reading on page one that Eric Stoltz does not star in a film called Back to the Future. So what I found, and I've always had this, I think, in all of my books, but Back to the Future really was an excellent example. One of the best sources for that book was actually Dean Cundey, who is the cinematographer. Because if you think about it, he was there for all three films. He was behind the camera for almost, unless it was like a second unit situation, he was behind the camera for almost all of the shots. So he was there. And then as the cinematographer, he's there for a lot of the downtime on the set as well. And so he was great because he had such interesting insights that I think a lot of times people always want to know, well, what did this actor have to say about that? What did this actor have to say? But the reality is, like, a lot of the times the actors are like in their trailers, you know, on sets. They aren't there while everything's getting set up.
Yeah.
And while it's great to sort of, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but like, it's great to be able to say, well, what did so-and-so have to say about making the film, you know, this A-list actor or something like that. The reality is a lot of the crew often have the more interesting stories.
Yeah.
So I always like to talk to the crew, and they did provide a lot of really colorful stories. I think another thing that sticks out to me about that interview process is something that Leah said when I spoke to her, where she said, you know, the Back to the Future trilogy, while obviously she, you know, she does conventions, she's, you know, she's never for a single day shied away from being Lorraine Baines. But she said they still are kind of bittersweet for her, because there isn't a single scene in any of those three films where she isn't working with someone who either didn't make it all the way through the trilogy or is a replacement for someone who didn't make it all the way through the trilogy. And so Eric was a very good friend of hers. Crispin was a very good friend of hers. And so while, you know, she's very proud of the films and, you know, it had a great time making them, it was a little bit hard for her to, especially to go back and refilm scenes that, you know, when her friend Eric, you know, wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
You know, she really had a hard time warming up to Michael, because, you know, he wasn't Eric, you know. And so, and also he was a sitcom actor and she was a movie actor, and at that time, you know, movies, you know, television isn't what it is today.
Wasn't the same thing. Yeah,
right. So it was that was sort of interesting. And so I think that was an interesting kind of anecdote. Sure. From the book.
So just a couple of things before we wrap up. When you are writing a book like E.T. or Back to the Future, and in a way, for the lack of a better word, you know, the production company or the studios picked you, right? Is there ever a time where you had a disagreement? And I'm not trying to ask you this from a controversial standpoint, just more so, you know, because when I ask people questions too, for my projects and documentaries, it's like there's sometimes some questions that people are not comfortable asking. And if somebody asked me a question that I'm not comfortable, I would probably, you know, tell them that I'm not comfortable. But was there ever a moment where there was a disagreement? No, we shouldn't do this, or we should, for whatever reason. If there was, what was a consensus? How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I can honestly say, not that I can recall. Honestly, and I say that to say, with both of these, you know, with I guess I'll talk about Back to the Future first. You know, Bob was very interested in just telling a good, you know,
story,
documenting the history, you know, in the best way. And I was honestly, maybe, you know, this question is sort of making me realize, maybe this is an answer to your previous question as well, because I think Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis, both of them, were so forthcoming with Back to the Future, where I would ask things that I was like, ooh, I don't know if they're going to answer this, or, you know, I was a little bit nervous to ask, and they just gave me just the most generous answers that it sort of established a little bit of a fearlessness in me, I think, in subsequent projects where I figured if someone doesn't want to answer the question, they won't answer it. But you never know. Maybe they'll give you, you know, a wonderful answer. The same with talking to Steven about like the 2002 release and a lot of the criticism of it and, you know, whether or not he was personally impacted by the criticism, how he felt about it. Was it fair? Was it unfair? You know, I could see that maybe being a little bit of a dicey question, but he was very generous, you know, in his answer. And I think it gave me a very truthful answer. So there really wasn't anything that was ever off limits. And I think the other thing too is, you know, I am a fan of these films. So, you know, when I approach it, like, yes, I think there were challenges, there were pitfalls in some cases, you know, there were controversies maybe on set or in the making of the film. But at the end of the day, the work was amazing. And I'm always a firm believer that a story of triumph only comes when there's some rough spots,
oh, yeah.
You know? So because Absolutely. Of that, it was, they all have happy endings, right? You know, and so yeah. Because of that, I feel like no one was really too shy about discussing some of the more challenging aspects of it.
You mentioned something interesting about being a fan of these movies and then writing a book. How do you, at a personal level, push yourself to be objective and separate yourself from being a fan than writing a book? And like, how's that?
Yeah, I think that's something that I've gotten better with, frankly, over time. You know, I think it's, you know, I'm, you know, to be wonky about it, you know, I went to school for journalism. You know, I spent some time at ABC News, you know, and so I like I, in turn, I don't want to like, you know, I don't want to oversell it, but like I did do some work on stories and things like that. And so
it shaped you.
Yeah. I really, that aspect, I think to me isn't even something that I have to think about all that much because I just approach these things both journalistically and also it's a book. So it does have a story in the same way the documentary has a story. You know, there is an arc. So that's, I think, what separates, you know, when people, I will say, you know, it's funny because sometimes when you look at the review, you know, when you look at Amazon or Goodreads reviews or anything like that, you know, there are always people that are like, oh, well, I knew some of this already. You know, oh, well, I knew Eric Stoltz was cast before. And it's like, well, sure. I mean, obviously, I mean, some of this information is out there, but I think the crafting of it into a compelling story that's fun to read, interesting to read. And I think, you know, one of the greatest compliments that I received from just like a regular reader who I met at a convention once, he said, you know, I knew Eric Stoltz obviously wasn't going to be, you know, wasn't going to make it all the way through Back to the Future. Of course, huge Back to the Future fan, but it was still a page turner to find out, you know, there were conversations taking place here. There were conversations taking place here. Who knew what, when, how they were going to break the news, what the fallout was, how they had to regroup, how they were going to, you know, change the costumes and sort of, and all of that was really exciting, even though I knew what the conclusion was going to be.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's, it's a sort of, fun thing as a fan to be able to
right.
take people on that ride.
It's funny you mentioned that because, Robert Zemeckis' film, What Lies Beneath and Castaway. I don't know if you've seen those.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this because, at the time I used to run a very successful DreamWorks fan site and that was my life for like a good 10 years. When Castaway trailer came out and What Lies Beneath trailer came out, they came out like 7 months apart. Mm. Both trailers pretty much gave away the film.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm. And people were so, even like Variety, I shouldn't say Variety, media outlets were so frenzied about the fact that why would you put so much in the trailer?
Mm-hmm.
And his answer before the film even came out is that people like to know what they're going into. And they would still watch it. And I even at that time thought maybe is he right or is he wrong? But he was right, because both those films made killer box office, even though people knew what they were going into. Just like you said, like, you know, even if people know what has happened, they still want to, genuine readers and genuine moviegoers, they want to see someone else's perspective of how that panned out. Now, if it was exactly the same, yeah, then they're going to say stuff, but it's important to have a different eye, because everybody brings something different to a story, even if it's been told before, like remakes, like West Side Story, right? Like Spielberg's remake. So,
well, yeah. So just, you know, along those lines, the two things I always like to remind people, right along the lines of what you're saying, is everyone knows something about Romeo and Juliet before you've read Romeo and Juliet, before you've seen it. And the thing that I always remind people is the very first audience to see Romeo and Juliet, when they sat in the theater, two people came out on stage and they said, two households, both alike in dignity, in Fair Verona, where we lay our scene. And they go through the entire plot. They tell you that Romeo and Juliet die in this play, and then they start the play. It is fully spoiled before the play begins, and yet it's still exciting to watch. And you know, again, talking about having a journalism background, every newspaper headline is,
gives away, you know, everything.
Gives away everything, you know. That's two true. People killed in house fire, cat survives, you know, whatever it is, like, spoiled before you even read the story. But then it makes you go, my goodness, how did that happen? And then you read the article.
You read it. That's actually a good point. I never thought about the media headline in a similar way. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add before I talk to you about the final closing arguments, closing discussion of the book?
No, you know, what I will add, and I'm realizing, because I'm staring at this book right here, I just want to come through it and show you a little bit.
Please.
This is the book here.
Great.
And this is the back, because I don't think anyone's seen the back yet.
Actually. No, I have. Well, that's a nice photo. I've never seen that photo of Spielberg directing.
That's so awesome. It's hard because it's so large to kind of like thumb through it in a sense. So I'm just going to go to like a couple random pages, and here we go. So here are some early, I don't know if you can wait. There we go.
Yep, there we go.
And the book has all of these great attachments. So you can see, like, this is all just inside the book. Can you see this?
Yeah,
there, yep. Like, all of these, so it just folds, and this is here for,
nice.
Let me see what else I can, I'm just choosing some random pages
here. Yeah, that's fine.
But here, there's like building the model for, I'm not very good at doing the zoom.
Just hold it with your both hands like this, maybe that.
Wait, let me do this. I got it. Hold on a second. This is probably better.
Yep, that's awesome.
And you can see there's attachments that are falling out again.
That's all over. Okay.
There's attachments everywhere. Let me see. Is there anything you want to see? Maybe I can. What's something that you'd be interested in seeing? Maybe I can.
I want you to pick something that you are the most proud of, because obviously I haven't seen the book, so I don't know what's in there.
So here, I'm going to show you. This is okay. I'm going to show you a picture that I'm really excited that are in here. These are in. Can you see these pictures here?
Yeah. So
these are Matt Demerit. These are two pictures of Matt Demerit in a prototype of the ET body puppet. And these two pictures are actually from Steven Spielberg. Those are Steven Spielberg's pictures that he took, and literally they have never been published anywhere before. That's just a little
piece. Are there any other Polaroid photos that he took that you can share?
There are other Polaroid.
Polaroid, not Polaroid. I don't know.
That's okay. I'll just go to another. I know in particular that those two were Steven's. I'm not sure if
that's fine.
Sorry, I know I'm thumbing, watching me thumb through is not all that exciting. Oh, actually, here's another thing that I will that's sort of fun to show. This is a photo, an illustration rather, by Drew Struzan, who
did
the concept art. And this is actually an early depiction of Elliot before Elliot had been cast. So this is not just a concept. So this is obviously not Henry Thomas. This was not modeled after Henry Thomas, but this was just sort of some concept art. Yeah. So it's a full history. It's really visual. And I think the stories that people tell will also be really, people really enjoy them. I'm excited. Now I'm just looking at myself.
When is the book out, and who's the publisher, just so people know, and where can they get it from?
Sure. The book is out August 23rd. It's E.T., the Ultimate Visual History. E.T., the Extraterrestrial, the Ultimate Visual History. And it is the publisher's Insight Editions. They do these great Ultimate Visual History books that, if you haven't seen their line of them, you should go check them out. I wrote one on the Dark Crystal as well, which is also celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And I'm not just saying it because I wrote it. You're going to be...
No, I can tell. Looking at just the excerpts of it, it looks fantastic. And what's next for you? What are you working on, or you're taking a break? Or
I can't say just yet, but I'm always working. I'm always working.
Is it film related?
I can't say just yet.
That makes sense.
Can't say just yet, but I'm always working.
That's good. That's fantastic. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time. Unless you have something else to add, I would love to chat with you in the near future about maybe Back to the Future in more detail.
Sure.
This has been great, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Looking forward to the book, and hope to see you at the movies.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you so much, man. Have a great day.
Great. Thanks, you too. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for watching and listening. Don't forget to subscribe, like, share, and comment, and do come back for another episode. Until then, have a great day.